Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Hornsby. Today, we're going to talk about what happens when people make so much money, they become so wealthy, that they need to abandon student loan forgiveness. What a wonderful problem to have. Speaking of people who are wealthy, one thing that I wanted to start off today's show mentioning is that we have a major bank partner for practice owners and aspiring practice owners that are looking to apply by the end of March, is running a promotion right now where you can get a 1% interest rate for the first 18 months and then a super low rate after that. This is the best deal that I've seen on practice financing. So this would apply to you folks out there who are looking to refinance existing practice debt to a super low rate, or to folks that are looking to make a move and buy a practice or do a partnership buy-in sometime in this kind of spring 2021 kind of time frame. So if you want to get access to that deal, just send an email to podcast@studentloanplanner.com or just use the contact form on our website and let us know and we'll make that intro to that team. In terms of the topic of today's show, making so much money that you're abandoning student loan forgiveness, this is really exciting stuff, because it means that you're making so much money that you don't need to do forgiveness anymore. So I've had a lot of high income, especially medical professionals lately, calling me or emailing me and saying, hey, I worked with you around the time when you first started this whole thing in 2016, 2017, and you said that if I ever made more than $500,000 a year, I should hit you up because we're going to have to talk about this whole, you know, going for forgiveness thing again. And these are people with really large debts in a lot of cases. I mean, these are folks that in some cases have $500,000, $600,000 of student loan debt, and you would think that that would be a slam dunk forgiveness case pretty much no matter what. And here they are only a few years after talking to me thinking, hey, you know what, maybe I should abandon this idea of student loan forgiveness and actually pay it off. So that's really exciting when it happens. It's not necessarily a super common thing, because it's not super common that somebody would have that kind of debt and then make $500,000 a year, right? Like most medical professionals even do not make anywhere close to that. Even if you're in a high income specialty, a lot of times maybe you want to live in a place where there's a lot of other young, attractive people, like a big city, and you want to meet people that way, right? Maybe you just have a preference that you want to raise your family in a place where you grew up, and maybe that is a big metro area where there's a lot of competition. If you think about it, you know, there's a lot of things to consider when you're considering abandoning student loan forgiveness. But first, you know, you can think about abandoning forgiveness. You could talk about that in multiple different ways. So for example, what I mean by that is you can abandon student loan forgiveness in the private sector where you're, you know, not doing the 20 to 25 year thing anymore. And you can also abandon it when you're doing public service loan forgiveness. So there's multiple different kinds of abandoning student loan forgiveness to talk about. I guess there's also one where you're not doing the, you know, go work at a federally qualifying health center, getting tens of thousands of dollars a year they'll give you towards your student loans. It's kind of like a student loan forgiveness thing too. You might, you know, some people might consider abandoning that. So there's a lot of different kinds of forgiveness programs that you might be tempted to abandon. So we're going to talk about a lot of the different ones. I think it probably is a good idea to start with abandoning public service loan forgiveness, because this one, you know, it definitely comes up quite a bit. And I think it's probably a little bit easier to talk about than some of the other ones. So we'll start off with that one, and then we'll maybe talk about some of these others, because they're all just really interesting cases to consider. Because that's one of the most common questions we get in our consults for our consultants that they have to answer is, okay, but what happens if I, like, how much money do I need to make for this to not be a good idea anymore? That's what we're going to try to answer in today's show. So think about it kind of like this. Let's say PSLF. Let's talk about that first. So we know that the PSLF program, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, is something that you can qualify for if you work full-time at a not-for-profit or government employer and you make 120 months of qualifying payments while employed at said employer on direct loans, direct federal student loans. Could you make so much money that you would need to abandon that? Well, let's think about it. If you're a physician, you had to do a residency, pretty much 100%, right? If you're a physician, you did some sort of residency. For primary care, sometimes that residency is as short as 3 years, but that residency can oftentimes be a lot more than that. You know, if you add on fellowship, it's not uncommon for people to have 6 to 8 year type training programs for a lot of different specialties out there. So that's a long time where you're making 60 something thousand dollars a year where if you manage your loans the right way, you consolidate to a federal direct consolidation loan right after graduation from medical school, then you will be building credit towards forgiveness, towards PSLF forgiveness specifically, right away in that first few years. So at a minimum, you would get 3 years of qualifying credit towards PSLF, right? Even somebody who's making a gazillion dollars would have 3 years of qualifying credit towards PSLF at a fairly low income level, probably $200-$300 a month type of payments. And it's even better than that, because think about how they calculate income-driven repayment. They look at the prior year tax return specifically. So if they're looking at the prior year tax return, when you graduate medical school, your first 12 months of payments is $0 a month. And don't worry, we're going to talk about lawyers and dentists and veterinarians and those kind of folks later too with the non-PSLF cases, because those are far more common. You know, PSLF is obviously by far the most common forgiveness program for physicians. And, you know, some lawyers out there, they qualify for it. But generally speaking, with lawyers, the reason why I'm not talking about lawyers right now is because lawyers, you know, if they qualify for PSLF, it's not because they're making a ton of money. They're not probably making a ton of money. They're probably making, you know, some sort of five-figure sum, whereas a lot of physicians can qualify for PSLF making as much as $500,000 a year working at a, you know, place that just happens to be a qualifying nonprofit. So anyways, you can build up this credit towards PSLF while you're in residency or fellowship if you're a physician. And even if you had a three-year residency and that's it, when you finish your residency program, you would have an extra year of payments at that residency income level when you finish residency. Because again, they're always looking at the prior year tax returns. And the question on the IDR certification form does not say what is your income. It basically says what was your most recent taxable income. And then they ask you later on in that certification, did your income decline? Which obviously, if your income went up, the answer to that question is no, it did not decline. So in other words, if you answer the questions truthfully, somebody with a three-year residency essentially gets 4 years of ultra-low payments. The fifth year is, generally speaking, a hybrid year where you're paying based off of income that's half of a year as a resident or fellow and half of the year as a attending, meaning that even your fifth year would be relatively low payments. You know, maybe say $1,000 a month if your residency payments are $300 a month, and let's say you become an attending, and now your attending payments are the full $2,000 a month or whatever. So as a general rule, if you take your residency training period and add 2 years, that's the total number of years that you get really low payments for. In the case of this, you know, primary care person or that's making a gazillion dollars, which, you know, call me if this is you, because wow, right? If you're making a gazillion dollars as primary care, something is pretty exciting there. You know, even somebody with 3 years of training, which is a very short residency, would basically already have 4 or 5 years of qualifying credit towards PSLF if they happen to be working at a nonprofit or qualifying employer. So let's say that this person's got kind of a modest amount of debt, like $120,000, something like that. Well, for about 5 years, your payment would be, I'm just doing this math kind of rough at the top of my head here, $120,000 means your 10-year standard plan's about $1,200 a month. So that means that as long as you're on pay-as-you-earn or revised pay-as-you-earn, I made that little verbal mistake there. It's pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment, pay or IBR. Those are the two plans that have a cap on the monthly payments at the standard 10-year plan. What is that cap? It's roughly 1% of what you owe. So if your, you know, amount is $120,000, your cap, if you will, is about $1,200 a month. So $1,200 a month times about 5 years or so worth of payments, you know, that's pretty attractive. It's, I mean, again, just 1,200 times 12, maybe around 14,000 times five, maybe, what is that? Maybe 70,000 something. I apologize if I'm doing this math wrong, but it's, again, off the top of my head here. This is a exciting podcast, right? Woo! So 70K or something like that would still result in you having the majority of that 120K that you had forgiven. You know, if you have $300 a month payments and for about 4 or 5 years in training, and then you have 70K of payments on 120 grand and, you know, as an attending, that's better than a 0% interest rate. In fact, that interest rate basically is negative. You know, in other words, There's no situation ever, if you already have generated credit during training, that's the big if, where you would abandon PSLF because you're making too much money. Now, there are situations where you would abandon it if you are already on revised pay-as-you-earn because maybe you're not able to switch into pay or IBR. In other words, because repay, you can be on that and kind of get stuck. I've seen that happen a couple times, few times, actually, many dozen times, I should say, actually, because we've done thousands of student loan plans. There are a couple rare circumstances where somebody's like messed up the management of their PSLF overall, and like it doesn't make sense to do it anymore. My wife actually had that happen to her. That's one of the reasons I got into student loan consulting, is because I felt like, wow, this is so messed up that this happened to her. But in general, there's not a situation where you would make so much that you would abandon PSLF. Now, I did not say that there would be a situation where you would never want to abandon PSLF because you had a great private practice opportunity. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying if you would just work at a nonprofit regardless, or an academic hospital regardless, because that's just where you want to be, and you just want to be full-time because why not? That's what your goals are. That's what you enjoy. Then that's what I'm talking about. Like, there's no income there that if you manage your student loan strategy correctly, where you would not do PSLF even if you're making a gazillion dollars. If you're making, you know, say you have 5 years of PSLF credit and you have $100,000 of debt and you happen to be working at a, you know, academic center, and let's say you are making literally $1 million a year, if you're on pay-as-you-earn or IBR, your payment just gets capped at the standard 10-year plan, and then you're, by definition, that's not going to pay the whole debt down in 5 years left to go. So it's something to kind of really think about. There's really, if you're working at a qualifying employer, you really don't abandon forgiveness basically for any reason, except, hey, I found a job that I want to do in private practice and I would rather just do that. Think about it like this. It never makes sense to do PSLF because of the money, because student debt, worst case, is an income tax. So to make an analogy, you would not live in Nevada just because it has no income tax, right? When you really, let's say you really want to live in California, which has a 10% income tax. I've been to both states. You know, Nevada's nice, but no offense. The redwood forests, I could see why somebody would prefer those in California over the desert and the gambling, right? Just kidding. We like Nevada listeners too. It's a joke. Don't take it personal. But that's the idea, right? So many people are like, oh my gosh, I have to do this job because I get forgiveness or else I'm so screwed. No, that's not true, because I know that you would not take a job in a state that didn't have an income tax solely because of that lack of income tax. Now, that might be a factor. You might be like, oh, well, that's kind of a positive. It's a plus, but you wouldn't take that job specifically because of that. Does that make sense? So in the same way, you shouldn't take a job just because it offers student loan forgiveness. Now, what about non-PSLF forgiveness? What about taxable 20 to 25 year forgiveness? Because I want to talk to the dentists, lawyers, chiropractors, veterinarians, PTs, occupational therapists, pharmacists, et cetera, right? All the people out there that are thinking about doing like 20 year pay or 25 year repay. What about abandoning forgiveness? What kind of cases am I seeing where people are abandoning forgiveness in that situation? So we are expecting President Biden at some point will offer up a plan that is very similar to pay as you earn for 20 years with no tax bomb. This has not been done yet. It's totally a guess. We're seeing all kinds of weird stuff. Like people are, I guess the scammers are out talking about Biden student loan relief, Biden student loan forgiveness, all these kind of keywords they kind of hype up to make you think you're missing out on something. It's just confusion, right? Like there's nothing happening right now. You know, if you listen to this podcast, we're going to tell you, we're going to scream it from the rooftops to everyone if and when President Biden does change something big about student loans. But we're just speculating that he's going to try to do something, and it's going to be something that is progressive, but not extremely progressive. In other words, he is absolutely not going to cancel all student loan debt. Senator Elizabeth Warren does not even want to cancel all student loan debt. We're going to talk about student debt cancellation later in the show too. At some point, we think he's going to offer something more generous than the plans that exist today, except he might make it so that you cannot exclude your spouse's income from the payments. We'll see what happens. We're going to keep you posted. And to be honest, with the whole forgiveness stuff, like to abandon forgiveness, you kind of have to feel good about it. you know, not being a good deal for you in the future, no matter what. In our estimation, you know, that means that you have a debt to income ratio less than 1.25 to 1. You've got good disability or term life insurance, and you've got good money, cash in the bank, and you like the private sector, and you're happy in that kind of capacity. And so what kind of amazing things could happen where you would think about abandoning student loan forgiveness, or maybe to say it in reverse, what kind of things could happen where you'd be afraid to abandon student loan forgiveness? I'm not a legal expert. I have to say that. When President Trump suspended student loan interest, I didn't really think he had the authority to do that. And so in that same line, I don't necessarily think that President Biden has this authority either, because Congress has the power of appropriation and the power of the purse, right? And so it kind of seems weird how the student loan payment and interest pause costs billions of dollars, but it's not really showing up on anybody's like sort of bill, right? It's just sort of not there, and it's kind of weird. So who knows? I mean, who knows what's going to happen with the student debt cancellation movement, but my guess is that we're going to see $10,000 canceled for people in economic distress, and that's about it. Maybe if President Biden decides that it's in his interest to cancel student loan debt with an executive order politically, he might do that with the expectation that he's going to have to fight it in the courts, because that is absolutely something that, you know, you would see Republican interest groups challenge. Anyways, forgiveness, abandoning forgiveness. So what's happening? So some people out there are making a lot more money than they thought, and then forgiveness, because they hit that magic debt-to-income ratio, it no longer becomes a good option, because we're projecting their payments are going to be so high that they're going to pay the debt off completely. So again, that magic debt-to-income ratio number, I said 1.25. We used to say 2-to-1. So in other words, if you're a dentist with 200K income, 400K debt or less, you'd refinance. Well, now, you know, it's a lot more conservative. Now we're like 250K of student debt or less instead of 400. We used to say it had to be below 1.5 to 1. That number assumes that you'd have to pay a tax bomb. So our new guideline of 1.25 to 1 debt to income ratio, if it's lower than that, and or you're expecting it to be lower than that at some point soon in the near future, then it would be okay to pay your loans off. So that number assumes that there's no income tax bomb and you're able to do pay as you earn and exclude spousal income and things like that. So in other words, we are already assuming with that number that there will be no student loan tax bomb. So our advice now, we modify our advice based off of what's happening, you know, in Washington and the economy, reading the tea leaves, right? Like, we're trying to give people the best strategies they can use, you know, regardless of what happens. And so that's kind of the level that we think makes sense, no-brainer to refinance. Now, you could refinance or try to pay your debt off with a higher debt-to-income ratio. You definitely could. If President Biden made the new plan something you got opted into and less something that you opted out, like, maybe he would make it so that you couldn't exclude a spouse's income at all. And so maybe you get accidentally opted into this new plan and you can't go back to the old one you're in. And then, oh, shoot, I can't exclude my spouse's income from my payment. And if that happened, you know, that would push a lot of people into refinancing. It'd be real interesting to kind of analyze that, you know, who would opt out of a forgiveness plan that would force you to include your spouse's income? You know, if they're not careful with whatever default plan they decide to develop, I mean, you could actually see a lot more strategic divorces than exist right now for student loan reasons. I mean, we've only had maybe a handful of people that have gotten a strategic divorce in the history of our company because of student loans. And I think the reason we haven't seen more is because people can file separately for taxes, which is kind of good enough for a lot of people. But it'll be real interesting to see what they do with that. When Senator Lamar Alexander was leading the Higher Education Committee in the Senate, he was retiring. He basically tried to do repay for grad school loans and the 20-year forgiveness for undergrad. So he basically tried to replace everything and simplify the income-driven plans with one plan that was going to be 25 years for grad school, 20 years for undergrad, probably no ability to exclude spouse's income, and probably no income tax bomb. So it would stand to reason that President Biden's plan is going to be a little more generous than that. So that's kind of why we're trying to be conservative and say, okay, 1.25 to 1. There's another reason, though, that you would abandon forgiveness that's not related to you crushing it with your income. If you think there's going to be bad inflation, you would probably refinance now because you're assuming your income is going to go up with that inflation and make forgiveness a bad deal. So I don't talk about this a lot because, I mean, I'm not a gold bug or like a Bitcoin apostle or you know, something sort of very extreme, I guess, in my views on like what inflation will happen. Could there be bad inflation in the next 20 years? Of course there could be. If you had a really strong opinion that bad inflation was going to happen, then you would maybe consider overruling our sort of rules of thumb and say, you know what, if I can get a 3.5 for 20-year fixed, I'm going to do that because I think that we're going to have inflation of 5 to 10% over the next 20 years. And I just really like locking that low rate in because then I kind of get free money if I'm right. And if I'm wrong, I still have a payment that I can handle. So, I mean, that's when we start getting into the, well, if your debt to income ratio, you know, is better than 2-to-1 and you have a view like that, or you're really anti-debt, or you are, you know, just you like the idea of not having to file taxes separately for 20 years. I mean, that's defendable to pay your debt back. It is. It's not something that we are going to go out and recommend because I think one reason is like I'm very sensitive about making sure that our advice is unbiased. And like I like to err on the side of caution because obviously with our refinancing companies, they pay us advertising revenues. They're site sponsors. That's fine if we can be very conservative and manage our conflicts of interest and negotiate the biggest cash bonuses on the internet for you when you use our links because of us taking a lot lower commission than anybody else. But it's still a conflict of interest. So I think, you know, that's one thing, I think I tend to be a little more conservative on paying debt back. Meanwhile, like some other people out there, that there's groups out there that basically say they give free student loan advice, but then they only make money whenever you refinance. So what do you think their advice is going to be biased towards, right? That's why we charge, one reason why we charge a flat fee for student loan advice, because I want you to feel like it's actually in your best interest. That's the whole point of the advice. And that's another reason why we pay our student loan consultants the exact same, regardless of their recommendation. I don't know. So that's just some random thoughts there. But I really think that we can assume that long-term interest rates are going to be relatively stable for a few reasons. Without going down a rabbit hole, we've got an old population, a developed world that's getting older too. And, you know, one time when I was a bond trader, I was like, man, why is the U.S. bond yield so low? And they're like, well, if you're a German senior citizen and you can buy, you know, 0.1% in Germany, you can buy 2% in America, and you're probably going to buy 2% in America. And I thought, oh man, that's kind of interesting. So like I said, you know, if you think that inflation's going to be really bad, then you would want to lock in a low interest rate and just pay your debt back. But for us normal people that don't necessarily have a strong view on that, you want to think with forgiveness, like it's not something that you want to do unless it's really in your interest because it's not easy. It's not pleasant having to recertify your income every year. It's certainly something that I would not want to do unless I needed to. And it's not something that I would want to do to set up a tax bomb account to have to be thinking about it. It's not something that I would really want to think about if I could get away with it. Now, if it meant the difference between me paying, you know, an extra 50 grand to do that over 20 years, if I tried to pay it back instead of go for forgiveness, then I would go for forgiveness. I mean, that's kind of one of the things that we talk about in our consultant meetings is it's like, well, we know that people are biased towards paying down their debt, but we just want to pump the brakes a little bit to make sure that people are 100% sure of what that means in terms of lifestyle sacrifices and less flexibility in terms of your hours and the need to go out and earn an income of a certain level, right? So federal student loans have these unknown unknowns. You know, the interest freeze was not expected by anyone. That was not something that anybody saw coming. Obviously, nobody really saw COVID coming, you know, and if they said they did, well, sure. Right. I mean, nobody really knew this year was going to happen. And then nobody knew that the way that President Trump was going to react with student loans is pausing all student loan payments and interest kind of and somewhat indefinitely. Right. I mean, in September 2020, and now it's extended to September 2021. That's a year and a half of no payments and interest. Is that likely to happen again? I mean, I think the main reason why the power of the president to do this wasn't really hardcore challenge is because we're in a once in a lifetime, hopefully, kind of crisis where it's a national emergency, where you have these national emergency powers that in normal times people would scoff at, but in unusual times, people are like, yeah, sure, you can do that. federal student loans do have some protections. In 2036, you know, say we have President Ocasio-Cortez and we have a lot more progressive politics and everything gets canceled. Well, that would stink to have paid it back. But again, I think you think through it all these different ways and you think, okay, if I am making good money relative to the amount that I owe and I'm really going to have a really upward income trajectory, there could be inflation. I'm not sure, but I kind of think there could be, right? So that's why we say, you know, anything below a 2-to-1 debt to income ratio, you can think about it. Below 1-to-1 debt to income ratio. So in other words, if you owe less than what you earn every year, then it's extremely unlikely you're going to get any relief. You know, people ask me, you know, am I going to get forgiveness or something? You know, if you're making more money than what you have in student loan debt, it is extremely unlikely. Extremely, extremely unlikely. I can't stress that enough how unlikely it is that you're going to get forgiveness unless you are getting PSLF for the reasons I discussed earlier, right? But if you're not getting PSLF and you work in the private sector and you think you're going to be earning more than what you owe in student loan debt at some point in the next 5 years, you're not going to get any forgiveness. It's just very, very, very unlikely. The plan that President Biden talked about of allowing people to pay 5% of their income on their student loans, that's only going to apply for undergrads even if that passes. He's not going to extend that to graduate school loans because the Congressional Budget Office is a nonpartisan research group that is stocked with a bunch of economists that both parties listen to. They released a report kind of right before COVID that talked about how the vast majority of subsidies on student loans go to high-income, high-debt graduate professionals. So if you think about how do you make student loans more generous in a way that people would have widespread support for, you're probably going to go after lowering payments for lower-income people, middle-income people. You know, that's where the money is probably going to get targeted, I think, in the future. I think they're going to be a little bit more careful in targeting it that way. Like if you think about the Senator Elizabeth Warren plan, you know, she does phase out cancellation if you're above certain income levels. She makes sure that people don't get their entire amount forgiven. And she has also proposed plans in the past where people would actually have their, you know, the 150% of the poverty line deduction that you get before you make 10% of your income payments. She's suggested phasing that out for higher income earners. So I think that we're going to see student loan relief money increasingly go to people in lower income situations with moderate sized debts in the future too. So that's another point for abandoning forgiveness if you think that you're making enough money where it makes sense to do. Remember that your savings rate is the main determinant of your financial future. So when you think about, well, should I pay off my loans or not? Like, should I abandon forgiveness? I mean, the main thing I want you thinking about is focus on your savings rate. Don't worry so much about forgiveness or refinancing because the savings rate is what matters. If you think that you want to go invest a bunch of money and go for forgiveness, that's okay. If you decide I want to pay off my loans really fast, well, I put in, you know, a little bit for a retirement match, and you know, that's okay too. That's why you hear people who said, well, I did the debt payoff method and it worked great for me. Well, that's not because it was necessarily the smartest thing to do. It's because they are really good at having a high savings rate, right? So that's why you hear people that are like, well, don't trust forgiveness. I didn't trust it and I paid it all off and it worked great. Well, again, that's because they were saving a ton of money. And once they were done paying off their debt, you know, they had kept all of their financial desires in check. And now they don't have this lifestyle that's very different, that's consuming all these resources that now can go into investing and things like that. I want to give you some more examples of what happened with some of these clients that did a follow-up consult with us that needed to abandon forgiveness. You know, if you're a first-time dental practice owner, you don't know for sure what your income is going to be long-term. Let's say you acquire a practice that's doing $600,000 in revenue. Sometimes people drastically increase those revenues in a way that's almost a little unexpected. I had a client a few years ago who bought a practice in rural Texas. The practice was sitting around for a while because no one had offered this doc a deal that he liked. And he actually turned down a similar offer a couple years before this dentist client of ours offered him about the same. And he decided, you know what, I'm just going to take it. Because it's so difficult to convince a young dentist to move to this middle of nowhere place. And this person, I think, already had some kids and a spouse. So it was a little bit more easier pill to swallow, so to speak, of being out in the middle of nowhere. So this buying doctor looked through the procedures the practice was doing and he realized there was a lot of things that he could do that a 70-something-year-old dentist could not do. So think extractions, different kinds of procedures. So that was phantom revenue that existed in this practice that he purchased that he could literally just go and do the procedures because the people would have to drive for hours to get to somebody else that could do some of these things. And doing that and just being more efficient and just really being smart with business, this dentist doubled the practice revenue, made all the practice investments that made sense for what he wanted for his lifestyle, put money in the retirement accounts. And the CPA is like, okay, there's nowhere else to hide this money legally from taxes, right? So then he realized that he needed to refinance. But really what we see when people abandon forgiveness, it's usually because somebody gets a really high income in a private sector job, either as an employee with a really high income, like in a hospital system, if you're a physician, or you are a practice owner that overshoots or is growing more rapidly in income than you kind of expected that you might have. Another example that we had last month, a couple months ago, I guess, we had an orthodontist that had bought a $1 to $2 million revenue practice. He maintained and grew it. Was thinking maybe with COVID, revenues wouldn't hold up, but he got his PPP loan and it took care of the salaries for the practice for the couple months he was shut down. And then when he went back into the swing of things, he's busier than he's ever been. And his accountant's telling him he's going to have a record year and they're expecting continual record years in the future. This guy doesn't live in a community property state, so there's no sort of tricks to lower the payments. He needs to refinance his debt because we were thinking maybe his debt-to-income ratio might be right around that 1.5 to 1 level, in which case maybe you go for forgiveness because of all the reasons I mentioned earlier. But then his income is a little bit bigger than expected. He's already maxed out all those retirement accounts, so now he's really at that level where, okay, maybe we need to go ahead and lock in a low interest rate and pay it back. I don't want to belabor the dentist examples, but I had another one who had a small practice in a small town. She owned the building. There's not a big market in town for the corporate real estate investments. So, she can buy a place for a very cheap amount, and then she hired who she needed for her practice. You can get really good people in her community for $12 an hour for a front desk person instead of, $25 an hour for somebody in San Diego who maybe doesn't even want to be there, right? It's a big difference when you're talking about labor costs. And there's not a lot of competition in her area, so she can charge what she gets paid a lot more for procedures that she does. And people are really grateful because she's one of the few medical professionals in the community. What's even better is she's from there. People know her. She wants to stay there, has a couple kids. Her spouse is happy there. They own a house already, and that was really cheap. So she's got $500K of dental school debt, but she just started making over $400,000 a year. And she's expecting that to go up as she has already bought a lot of the equipment and depreciated some of it already, and she doesn't necessarily need a lot more. As long as she's got good disability insurance, good term life insurance, she doesn't have a ton of capacity to spend money in this more out-of-the-way place. She's feeling pretty good about paying back her loans now because she knows that she's going to be making, it's kind of all going to be going up from here. Initially, she was kind of thinking, well, maybe I want to do pay because maybe we want to have some more children and maybe I want to be able to do 3 days a week down from 4.5. But she's finding that she's really getting into her groove and her spouse is staying at home with the kids and she feels like, well, no, I like this. I want to do 4.5 days a week, and I like earning substantial amount of money for this expensive degree that I went out and got. So in that kind of a case, right, if somebody's a little afraid about refinancing, but it's pretty clear they need to, then it's maybe a good idea to start with a 20-year term. We talk about this a lot, the refinancing ladder approach. You start with a 20-year term, you make a lot of prepayments when you have the money. Maybe, for example, a lot of people will leave, a lot of dentists or practice owners will leave a lot of money in their business checking account until the accountant says, all right, here's your taxes, and they'll pull out a bunch as a lump sum, right? So maybe you make that big lump sum payment on your loans once a year, and then you pay it down to a certain level and you refinance it again to an even shorter term with a payment that you can feel good about so you don't have to be stressed about it. So if you feel like, hey, I'm thinking I'm going to make a lot more money than I ever really thought I was going to make, or hey, I kind of feel like inflation's going to get a lot higher from here. With the COVID forbearance, it's fairly straightforward. You wait until September the 1st around there, and then you have about 30 days that an offer is good for. So then you just apply, around Labor Day, if you want to think of a time to apply. And then you sign if the COVID forbearance is not extended past September 30th. We're probably going to know, I would imagine, sometime in August, whether or not President Biden is going to allow that forbearance to expire or not. But what if interest rates go up? What if interest rates go up? So refinancing is a much better deal now if you want to do an investing strategy and pay the minimum on your debt, because a lot of people, some people at least, would view anything less than 4% as really cheap debt that they would rather hold on to so they can invest money instead. Now, that's definitely an aggressive strategy. I think most people are a little bit risk averse and a little bit more cautious with that kind of thing. So that's why we suggest the refinance ladder, because you start with a low payment, you pay a lot down, then you do a 10-year, you pay a lot down, then you do a 5-year. That keeps your required payment pretty low compared to if you just jump straight into a 5-year term with a $10,000 a month payment, it can get in the way of a lot of things. So for example, one time we had a dental specialist who could barely afford childcare plus her student loan payment because she refinanced to like a 7-year term and she couldn't even qualify for a practice loan because of her required student loan payment being so high. So then she re-refinanced to a 20-year, qualified for the practice loan, and then was able to get that loan term back down to a shorter term again after she established the practice that she wanted to, which would give her enough income to pay it down rapidly in the first place. If you do have over $100,000 in cash, you know, you probably can do a 10-year fixed rate on your loan. I mean, you probably can. Now, one quick note, what about inheritance? Does that cause you to abandon student loan forgiveness? No. Let's say you've got $1 million in an inheritance. That's not a taxable event, at least on the federal level, depending on, you know, obviously if your person giving you the money was worth tens of millions of dollars, maybe there's estate taxes, but that's not your liability. So if you get, you know, a big inheritance, would it affect your going for forgiveness? It would not, as long as that income from the inheritance wasn't so substantial that it would throw off that debt to income ratio. So for example, if you got hundreds of thousands of dividends a year from an inheritance, then that would obviously impact your forgiveness strategy. It'd be better to pay it off. But if you're only, you know, say you inherit about the same amount of money as you have in debt, well, that doesn't change anything. It's still better to go for forgiveness as long as your income is expected to not drastically increase because of it. So something to kind of think about. We get that question from people sometimes. It's like, hey, I was fortunate to inherit $200,000. Does that impact my forgiveness at all? No, it doesn't. And if anyone wants to know where to inherit $200,000, I'm sorry, I don't have any leads for you. So let's talk about debt cancellation a little bit. So the student debt cancellation movement has been growing in momentum, and it really continues to become a thing that people talk about more and more as student loan debt has really quintupled in the past 10 years. You have different plans out there, and you have different views and opinions in the progressive community. So for example, Senator Bernie Sanders wants all of student loan debt to be canceled. Some of the members in Congress that you would view as the most progressive members are of in agreement of that. Now, Senator Elizabeth Warren, though, and some of those similar progressives to her have a targeted cancellation plan that is maybe politically realistic, because I don't think that you would see everything just canceled, because there is a reason why Democratic voters, I think, went with President Biden instead of Senator Sanders. And that's because I think that a lot of voters, some of the more pragmatic voters, viewed him as the best case or the best chance for beating President Trump. In the same token, I think the policies of forgiving all student loan debt all at once, maybe it's something that'll happen eventually, but I think that what we would need to see is first some really kind of blue wave type elections where you have like 56 Democratic senators in the Senate or something, right? I think that you would need something like that to convince, you know, your more moderate type Democratic senators to go ahead and do something like that. So I think that there's a chance that you could have 50K canceled, but I don't think that the Democratic Party is going to want to do that for electoral reasons, namely because all parties want to maintain power and control, right? And they want to win elections. And so in 2022, you know, it's not a presidential year. Obviously, President Biden was Vice President Biden during the 2010 elections with the Tea Party movement, where you had this big backlash to some of the things like the Affordable Care Act. So I'm talking about this stuff not in a political sense. I'm talking about it from a how do you predict what's going to happen with student debt cancellation sense. Hope you know that. So why would they not cancel $50,000 of student loan debt through Congress? The reason is because it would cost around $900 billion. Contrast that to the total stimulus bill of $1.9 trillion that President Biden put forward. So you're right at like, if you cancel 50K for everyone, that's like half of the entire, call it first quarter agenda of President Biden's first 100 days or whatever, right? I mean, that's like an insane amount of money, like compared to the total stimulus that they're asking for, right? It's not an insane amount of money in terms of like, could Congress afford to do it? Sure, it could. I mean, could we afford to cancel all student loans? Of course we could. It's more about like all these competing priorities. And there's something called PAYGO rules. PAYGO is, and I'm not a legislative expert, but essentially, why is there such a push to do this via executive order instead of via Congress? Well, in PAYGO rules, if you do something that has this huge impact or this huge cost associated with it, you have to raise taxes or come up with cutting spending, or you have to borrow the hundreds of billions of dollars to do it. However, if you do it via executive order, and I'm not really clear why it is this way, but if you do it via executive order, when President Trump suspended student loan payments and interest, the Department of Education made an announcement about how much it would cost, but they didn't really say anybody had to pay it. They didn't really say, okay, we got to go borrow X amount to cover the cost of this suspended payments and interest plan. That just kind of happened and kind of really weird, right? Like, that's kind of one reason why I felt like the executive didn't really have the authority to pause student loan payments and interest, because it doesn't increase the national debt, except that it does. And it's kind of weird, like, follow me here if you want. But so the executive order idea, so one of my friends, you know, student loan expert friends, texted me and he's like, and he's a big advocate for a cancellation. And he texted me and he's like, oh man, this is not a good sign that they're having this press conference that they want to cancel student loans via executive order. And I said, why is that? Why is that a bad sign? This seems like a positive sign for student debt cancellation. And he said, because if there was support in the moderate wing of the party and Congress to do it, then they would do it via Congress, because if they do it via executive order, it's going to get immediately challenged in the courts. And if you have a 6-3, you know, Republican appointed majority in the Supreme Court, it's probably going to get shot down. And so if you really had actual legislative support for this, they wouldn't be announcing this with a press conference. This seems more of like a sort of a, they want to make sure that their base knows politically that they advocated for this. You know, so it's kind of weird, right? So does cancellation increase the national debt? Who the heck knows? I think that's the honest answer. Because would it have an amazing impact on the economy? Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, what would you do if all your student loan debt were canceled? You'd probably be a lot more inclined to buy a house, maybe start a family. You'd have a lot less anxiety. It would be a wonderful thing. Except what exactly would happen with other things that the country would spend money on? Who knows? The student debt is the largest asset owned by the U.S. government. And if you ditch that asset, then that's not going to affect the national debt right away, because assets and debt are two different things. So, I mean, when you hear a lot of the talking points on this, it's really nuanced, because student loan debt on the government's balance sheet is an asset. On your balance sheet, it's a debt. And the national debt is the amount of debt the United States has. The student loan debt on the U.S. balance sheet is an asset. So if you wipe away those assets, then you're wiping away the payments associated with that. And so to the extent you have a lot fewer payments coming in, if you cancel student loans, then that means that's going to increase the national debt over time. Who the heck knows, right? Who the heck knows? I guess, this is just a total guess, that if they canceled student loans, it would probably increase the national debt somewhere between like $500 billion to $1 trillion over 10 years. That's a lot less than the Trump tax cuts. But who knows if that's going to get passed? I mean, I really don't have much of an idea if it would. And, you know, the other thing is let's say that we could do student debt cancellation, which would be a great thing. I would do something else. Maybe I would rebrand the podcast, the Travis Makes Weird World War I Analogies podcast. I don't know if anybody would listen, right? But, you know, I would find something else. And I recognize, you know, that we have a potential conflict of interest of, you know, okay, if student debt's cancellation, well, you would not have anything to do for a living. Well, yeah, I'm going to admit that, like, except that I think I could come up with something else. Don't cry for me if that happens, because we're just fine. But if you cancel student loan debt and you don't do anything with tuition, that would be, I think, a disaster for future generations. And what I mean by that is, if you're going to cancel student loan debt, I think you have to pair it with regulation on schools. So think about what your school did to you. They charged you what they thought they could get away with rather than what would give you a good deal. And they did that because they didn't have to have any restrictions on the cost of attendance for what they gave you in student loans, because the federal government will give you the full amount that you want. I think even the most progressive person can say that it would be a good thing if, like, say a very progressive person would say all of schooling should be free. That's a reasonable political view to have. But that if it were, that the government should push down the cost by regulating the market, right? And in the case of higher education, there's basically no regulation at all. So it's kind of weird. You have like really high levels of government involvement, but absolutely no like government price setting. So think about like Medicare, like, you know, Medicare basically tells a lot of providers what they're going to pay, right? So there's a lot of like price controls, but then there's a lot of involvement to expand access. Whereas like in the higher education market, there's a lot of involvement to expand access, but very little efforts at controlling costs and canceling student loan debt without changing the way things are done in that regulation side of things would be, you know, it would crowd out other priorities. It would crowd out being able to address climate change and healthcare and lessening inequality and other things. So I don't know. It's just a really fascinating problem. Like anybody who says that they have an easy fix to the student loan crisis probably hasn't thought about it enough. And I don't mean that in a mean way. I just think this problem is extremely complicated and there's all kinds of unintended consequences pretty much no matter what you do with student loan reform. So maybe that means it stays complicated. Maybe that means that we still need to have a place in your life. And so if that's the case, then I'll try to keep making this podcast entertaining so you keep tuning in, I guess. We'll know what happens, I think, around April, May, June. I think once the end of the interest freeze kind of gets closer, I think we're going to start seeing some indications as to what President Biden might do. But just know that if you have a debt-to-income ratio below 1.25 to 1, or you think your income's heading that way just because you're really beating all your income targets that you thought you were going to have, and you're just really crushing it, then yeah, you should pay your debt off. One more thought about student loan relief in 2021. So think about this. This is not something that was consciously thought of, but this is something that ended up happening. Think about inequality in America. There's inequality between the billionaires and a orthopedic surgeon, but there's also inequality in an orthopedic surgeon and a waiter. One of the interesting things with the student loan interest freeze is the way they designed it by having it not be cancellation. It was a payment and interest freeze that disproportionately benefited high income, high debt borrowers like you and like people that like our podcast and that hire us for planning. So our community got a great benefit and that's wonderful. That's one of the reasons why I think future student loan relief is going to be more targeted, because here's an example. A future orthopedic surgeon in residency who would eventually refinance got from this student loan payment and interest pause, got a 0% interest benefit for a year and a half. So on $500K, that's saving that person about $45,000. You know, let's say somebody who's PSLF eligible is making a high income, maybe you say a dermatologist or something, or somebody who, you know, is like an ICU critical care doc that you'd kind of say, wow, that's like a great person to just wipe the whole debt after what they've been through with COVID, right? That person would have been paying, let's say, $3,000 a month or $2,000 or $3,000 a month for PSLF credit. Instead, that's been zero. So if you sum up the year and a half of paused payments, it's about $54,000. So you can easily see where somebody who has a lot of debt, high income, got a subsidy of like a brand new car or paused payments of PSLF of like mid five figures. Meanwhile, someone who completely lost their income, right? Like somebody like a waiter or a bartender or somebody like that with $10,000 of debt from maybe a degree that they dropped out from, they got $800 of interest benefit over the past 1.5 years. So you've got a lot of people out there that were most affected by this COVID crisis financially that got student loan relief that was a few hundred dollars versus a lot of people in our community that did need the help, obviously did need the help and were grateful for that help, but in a lot of cases got, you know, many multiples of the level of help. And that's why I think you're going to see a big push towards student debt cancellation, because in all fairness, like lower income people that have bared the brunt of this economic crisis probably should get disproportionately more help, right? So we'll see what happens. Who the heck knows? But speaking of, again, high income borrowers that are practice owners or aspiring practice owners, reach out to us if you want to hear about that 1% fixed rate promo deal for the practice loan refinancing and for taking out practice loans to close a deal in the first half of 2021. So if you want to get more details about that deal, just send us an email to podcast@studentloanplanner.com. A little bit of a personal announcement. I'm going to take the months of April and May off from consulting. I'm going to be obviously working full time in the business, don't you worry, but I'm going to be focusing on several different projects, website type projects that I want to really spend a lot of time on while we're getting ready for this payment and interest freeze to end. And I'm expecting that's going to be an insane level of activity when that happens for people that need help. And there's not anything in particular that requires you to wait to get that help. It's a great time to get that help because we're still saving people a lot of money, filing their taxes the right way, explaining how to do the right consolidations, how to select the right repayment plan. That stuff really isn't dependent upon student loan payments being frozen or not. So if you do need help in getting a student loan plan, obviously studentloanplanner.com/help, you can get a plan there. But just know that if you wanted to book me specifically, I'm only doing the 400K plus event type on Fridays only now, just because so much of my time is really just spent on running the business. Now that we have, I also want to announce we have two new consultants, Dan Roker and Molly Lafter, both CFPs. Molly is also a CFA and MBA. The new additions to our team, that brings our consultants besides me up to five consultants. And I'm going to also be focusing on, you know, making sure that onboarding process goes really smooth. But I'm really excited. We're, you know, getting ready for this payment and interest freeze to end from a business perspective because we want to be ready to serve you when it does happen. Reach out, podcast@studentloanplanner.com, if you want to get that limited time offer on the practice loan refinancing or the taking out a practice loan. That's really the amazing deal. So please reach out about that. And if you have questions or comments about the podcast, hit me up. Thank you everyone for listening. And if you do happen to be one of those high income people that abandons forgiveness, more power to you, but at the end of the day, you don't have to do it either. Thank you for listening.